David Albert, Ph.D. Quantum Physics Consciousness Science.
Okay, first off, I know you talked about this earlier today, but, you know, the thing that you had said about, you know, what the foundations of quantum mechanics say as to, you know, there's a couple of things, obviously, the observer, you know, where does the observer fit in, you know, and the hook or non-hook of consciousness in that.
Right.
And so if you could talk about that and, you know, the probably more like this than like...
Yes, yeah. something that happens in quantum mechanics, one of the important innovations of quantum mechanics is that a certain fantasy that held in physics up until then about the possibility of observing something entirely passively, observing it without affecting it in the process of observing it. However things turn out, it's fairly clear now that quantum mechanics will have ended that permanently. Looking at things involves interacting with them, and it involves interacting with them in a way whose effect can't be minimized. No matter how delicate your technology is, no matter how much money you spend. So that's a new feature of quantum mechanics. Okay, this is getting too long. I take it this is going to be edited so I can stay stuck like that.
Were you saying by that, though, that they found now that the observer has no effect?
The process, the physical process of making a measurement has a very profound effect. There have been a whole bunch of speculations in the literature as to what it is about the process of making a measurement that has this effect and how it is that the process of making measurements have the effects that they do. One of the speculations about this, which had its heyday in the 50s and 60s in the scientific and philosophical literature, was that the active agent here was consciousness. And people were excited about this for all sorts of obvious reasons. It was a very new sort of link between physics and something that had seemed altogether outside of physics up until then. Much of the talk in quantum mechanics that goes on in the film is centered around these speculations. And one of the points I wanted to make this morning was that those speculations haven't played a role in what I regard as the serious scientific and philosophical literature on this subject for 30 years or so. There was a certain period where people were speculating like that. There was, as I mentioned this morning, a series of progressively more and more embarrassing conversations of the form, well, can a cat cause these effects with its consciousness? Can a mouse cause these effects with its consciousness? Eventually, it was clear that the words involved here were so imprecise, were so slippery, that you weren't going to be able to build a useful scientific theory around them, and the idea was dropped. It's also the case that even if those ideas had turned out to be useful and true in physics, they wouldn't have produced the picture of the world that it seems to me we get in What the Bleep. Even if consciousness was the agent, all of these theories had the operations of this consciousness regulated by very strict, external, concrete, soulless, mathematical laws. The jump from the involvement of consciousness, even if it was there, to these larger claims like I create my own reality, I choose my experience, consciousness is the foundation of all being, there's room in the world for this intangible phenomenon of freedom, so on and so forth, these wouldn't have followed even if the consciousness picture of measurement had succeeded, and the consciousness picture of measurement didn't succeed. So those are the points I was trying to make about that this morning. I mean, these are all points in a negative vein. there is the The positive thing to say is that there's a huge amount of interesting work going on over the last 20 years trying to understand how measurements do cause the effects that they cause. This work is all in a vein that, in the language of this film, would be called much more mechanistic, in the vein of a much more mechanistic picture of the world. This work has to do with trying to figure out how to alter the equations in order to produce these changes, or how to add things, add physical things to our picture of the world in order to show how these changes come about. They're not at all centered on issues of the possible agency of consciousness anymore.
So the thing about the measurement is
right.
Do they look at that now as sort of that the measurement is a coupled system with the thing that they're trying to measure?
Yeah,
and that
there is something that's really, you know, if you want to put your finger on one of the profound philosophical shifts between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics, it's that classical mechanics is built from the ground up around what we now know is a fantasy of the possibility of observing things passively, okay? Or the possibility of, at least if you get more and more careful, more and more and more closely approaching the position of observing things in a perfectly passive way. Observing things in such a way that you're sure that you're not, in the process of observing something, changing the very thing you're trying to observe. Quantum mechanics put a decisive end to that. This phenomenon of incompatible observables that I was talking about this morning makes it very clear that measurements, that there is a minimum and finite disturbance that you're going to have to cause to any system by measuring any particular one of its physical variables, and there is going to be no way, no kind of technological advancement that can reduce it below that definite finite level. Mind you, everybody always knew that in order to measure a system, you have to interact with it physically in one way or another, but like I say, the fantasy was that you could make this interaction more and more and more and more delicate as your technology got better. Quantum mechanics put a decisive end to that. Quantum mechanics gives us a theoretical, unsurpassable, finite, minimum interaction which you must have with the system if you're going to get any information out of it. That's a very decisive change. So, this picture of passive observation is gone. Like I say, it was a tempting move in the context of a discovery like that, to say, well, what do we mean by observation? What is it that's doing the disturbing? It was a natural thing to grab at something like consciousness. Observers have consciousness, so on and so forth. There were other things that they grabbed at just as instinctively. Macroscopicness, the macroscopicness of the measuring apparatus, as opposed to the microscopicness of the measured object. The cut between subject and object. There were all sorts of things to grab at. Consciousness was one of the things that was grabbed at. It was grabbed at very tentatively. It was in fairly short order followed up to the point where it looked like a dead end insofar as the progress of physics was concerned. And it hasn't played a role since then, except in certain attempts to appropriate quantum mechanics to other kinds of agendas, new age agendas or deconstructionist agendas or post-structuralist agendas or so on and so forth.
Now, could you talk a little bit? A lot of people have the notion that science is a very definite thing, and mm-hmm. there is one thing, and all scientists agree on that, and that science moves forward by very orderly things of science doing experiments. And it seems like the history of science tells us something very different.
Of course you're right about that. Of course you're right about that. And this is something that has come much more to the center of people's attention over the past 30 years or so with the writings of people like Kuhn and so on and so forth. Science is a very messy, very back and forth, very complicated, very social, very human institution, like other institutions are. Of course there isn't universal agreement among scientists, particularly about the foundations of quantum mechanics. Of course there are messes all over the place. But if you just say that and leave it there, I think you're not doing the situation justice. I think, and this is again repeating something that I said this morning, there is still a really important distinction between two quite different ways that you can come at the world. Both of them are imperfect. Both of them are messy. Both of them are back and forth. But there is a posture of coming at the world with the demand that you're going to find something that makes you feel good. You're going to find something therapeutic. You're going to find that what lies at the center of the universe, what lies at the foundation of all being, is some attractive, powerful, safe, accessible, reassuring image of yourself. This is the way the Vatican came at the world in its dispute with Galileo. This is the way the Victorians came at the world in their dispute with Darwin. The problem that the Vatican had with Galileo is that humanity was being displaced from the center of the universe. The problem that Darwin had, that the Victorians had with Darwin is that the ancestry of man wasn't as dignified and wasn't as reassuring as people wanted it to be. It seems to me that one of the important historical distinctions that science is entitled to is that it's science that always represents the resistance to this impulse. It's science that always represents the demand that you come at the world with open and authentic wonder and with sharp, cold, clear eyes and in a way that's singularly intent on getting at the truth, whether the truth ends up being reassuring and therapeutic or not. The statements in the film of the form consciousness is the ground of all being, or our consciousness links up with the consciousness of the unified field, so on and so forth, I must say, and this is what was primarily disturbing to me, I hear in all this vivid echoes of the Vatican's position that the Earth is at the center of the universe, or of the anti-Darwinian position that man was created by God, that we're somehow specially important, that we somehow have a special role to play, or a special link, a special connection with what's at the foundation of the world. We don't know that. And our job in searching through the world is to find out if that's true or not, not to come to the world with a demand that it be true, or not to select which scientific theory to believe based on whether that scientific theory seems to endorse that kind of claim.
What about, then, the role of intuition? Let's say, because a lot of, you know, mystical writings are, you know, sages, whatnot, enlightened beings.
Right.
They report certain things that,
right.
that they've experienced.
Right.
So that's more of the intuitional side, where it may not be that they're predisposed to think a human's the center of the universe.
That's fair enough.
Yeah, they just...
That's fair enough. Look, I think there are other ways of distinguishing between ways of coming at the world. There are great intellectual traditions of which I'm enormously respectful, of mystical access toward the world, of revelatory access toward the world, all sorts of stuff. Then there is a scientific tradition. And the scientific tradition is to approach the world, very roughly speaking, people talk about scientific method as if that's some distinct way of reasoning. Doesn't seem to me to be a distinct way of reasoning. What you mean by scientific method is some attempt to come at the world globally in the way you come at the project of getting a fire started, or building a house, or weaving your clothing, or something like that. There is this style of reasoning that we refer to as common sense. Okay, and the scientific project is essentially the project of seeing if we can expand the style of common sense as a complete approach to the world, as a complete approach to existence. I think this is an interesting and compelling project for two reasons. One, because common sense is a compelling way of reasoning. Two, because the project of applying common sense to the world as a whole has turned out to be spectacularly successful. On the other hand, it seems to me that you could perfectly well make an argument, look, common sense and not, say, mystical revelation is indeed the right way to fix your toaster. It's not the right way to decide what you think about God or what you think about the point of existence or something like that. For that, you need entirely distinct methods. Both of these are very interesting claims to make, very respectable claims to make. All that I think is bad is to mix them up with one another.
Do you think that in the future, in time, I mean, both are purportedly looking into the nature of the universe.
Right.
The big you.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
Do you think that there's a way in which at some point these will converge?
I don't see any reason to believe that. I think so far all of the announcements of this convergence, which are surely all over the place, have proven hollow. Once you look at them, so no, I don't see any. Indeed, I guess I see the opposite, and I guess I see, and you know, this is another way of putting the point that I was trying to make this morning. For my money, the image of the world and of our place in the world that emerges through science is getting more and more uncomfortable for us as time goes by, is getting farther and farther from the image of us that emerges in the great religious traditions, the great mystical traditions, so on and so forth. We're being presented with a mechanical picture of ourselves by science that we don't know how to take in. And I think the interesting challenge of science to our imaginations is not that it's reproducing other bodies of knowledge that we have other kinds of access to, but that it's giving us something altogether different from all of those other traditions, something with an enormous amount of force behind it because of the success and the earned authority of the scientific technique, something that it's very hard for us to take in. It's very, very difficult for us to think about ourselves as the kind of mechanical devices that science seems to be telling us that we are. So, no, I don't see evidence of a convergence there. And indeed, what I think is exciting about the scientific project is precisely that the way as it goes on, it makes this tension more and more and more acute. The tension between the picture of ourselves we have from various other cultural traditions and the picture of ourselves we're getting from science. Once again, if you look at the progress, Galileo took us out of the center of the universe where various religious traditions wanted to put us. Darwin took us out of you know, divine creation where various traditions wanted to put us. Freud displaced us in another way. I think the progress of science has been exactly away from convergence with all these traditions. And I think that's what's interesting and challenging about it. If all it was doing was converging with these other traditions, there'd be something redundant about it.
If you, let's say, you know, in physics, of course, the Holy Grail is the theory of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So you would then have to say that it's not the theory of everything, it's the theory of the physical, everything in the physical universe.
Yeah, but you might want to add to that that you think you have reason to believe that the physical universe is all the universe there is.
Right. Right. Now, but can science ever answer that question, that there is...
Whether the physical universe is all the universe there is?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure what it would be to answer that question definitively, but it's imaginable that physics could get to the point, okay, where it could say, look, I have a completely physical explanation of why you just moved your arm. I have a completely physical explanation of why you're now producing the sounds you're producing. I have a completely physical explanation of why you married the person that you did. I have a completely physical explanation of why you wrote all the words in your life that you did. if physics gets to that point, there's going to be more and more of a pressing question of the form. Look, this other stuff you believe in, this non-physical stuff that you believe in, what's it for? What work is it doing in the world? We have a complete account here in terms of physics of everything that seems to be going on, of why you believe, you know, of why to say, you say to people that you believe you have free will. We're going to have a physical account of why you say to people that you believe the world isn't completely physical. That's not going to be a proof that the world is completely physical, but it is going to raise a very awkward question for the person who wants to deny physicalism, if physics gets to this point, mind you. I don't know that it will, okay? But if it does, okay, then there's going to be a very acute question of the form, look, this other stuff you believe in, soul or spirit or whatever it is, what does it do? What's it for? We've got the account of everything in terms of the motions of these particles. Okay? We've already established that it's not what makes you say what you say. It's not what makes you write what you write. It's not what makes you marry who you marry. What work is it doing? Things could come to that.